Udemy Research, Kindergarten from First Principles, Episode 3. Welcome back to The Deep Dive. Today, we are taking on a topic that it really sits at the intersection of neuroscience, public policy, and, let's be honest, the practical chaos of every elementary school gymnasium floor. I'm talking about the midday nap. And if you're involved in early childhood education, you know, a parent, a teacher, or a curriculum designer, you probably see that rest period as, well, a logistical hurdle.
Or maybe a welcome moment of quiet for the staff.
Right. Or maybe even, you know, an hour and a half that's being taken away from real instruction.
And that framing right there, that perception of the nap as just a break, that is the foundational high-stakes mistake we're here to correct today. The whole mission of this deep dive is to fundamentally transform how you view that quiet time. We've synthesized a really robust body of neuroscientific evidence, mostly from the last decade, and the conclusion is just inescapable. Sleep is not simply time away from learning.
It's when it happens.
It is, scientifically speaking, the single most critical, non-negotiable period when learning actually becomes permanent.
So we're really talking about transforming the entire academic day. Not based on tradition or what some local regulation permits, but based entirely on the, well, the moment-by-moment function of the developing human brain. And to really underscore how urgent this is, we need to introduce the most counterintuitive and honestly shocking premise from this research right at the top.
Oh, absolutely. This is the finding that should make every single policymaker sit up and pay attention.
So what is it?
Okay, so here's the core finding. For a very specific, biologically defined group of preschoolers, the ones who still habitually nap skipping just a single midday nap can cause irreversible memory loss for complex things they learned that morning.
Irreversible.
Irreversible. And here's the critical follow-up. Subsequent overnight sleep, it doesn't matter how long or how deep it is, it cannot recover that damage. The window closes.
That's...
And that fragile memory is just, it's gone forever.
That is a massive claim. Permanent loss from missing one nap. If that's true, it means we've basically been designing our school schedules completely backward.
In many cases, yes.
So our journey today is to dive deep into that evidence. We're going to unpack the specific brain mechanisms using this really beautiful metaphor of the hippocampal desk. We'll differentiate between how the brain handles facts, what we call declarative memory, versus, say, motor skills. And then at the end, we're going to build a detailed evidence-based schedule, a blueprint for optimizing that pre-K or kindergarten day to make sure everything you teach actually sticks.
Let's do it.
All right, let's start with this idea of catastrophic forgetting, because it's not a theoretical risk, right? This was actually observed and documented.
It was, and the whole narrative really begins with this landmark study, a highly cited one, from Professor Rebecca Spencer's research team at the University of Massachusetts Amherst.
Okay, so tell us about this experiment.
It was just a brilliant, elegant design. They took 40 children, all between 3 and 5 years old, from local childcare centers. And in the morning, they were all taught a simple, new, visuospatial memory game. Now, this type of learning is foundational, right? It relies heavily on what's called the hippocampal circuit,
which is the brain's short-term memory system, the place for new facts, new spatial relationships.
Exactly. And the intervention itself was, you know, deceptively simple. After the learning session, the kids were split into two groups.
Well,
half of them were allowed to take their regular nap. They averaged about, 77 minutes of sleep. The other half was kept quietly awake, you know, looking at books, low stimulation stuff, but strictly no sleep.
And that controlled contrast is key. It lets you isolate the exact effect of the nap itself.
Precisely. And the immediate results, just a few hours later, were already clear. The kids who napped recalled 75% of what they learned that morning.
75%.
And the others?
The wake-deprived children, the ones just looking at books, they recalled only 65%. So that's a clean 10 percentage point drop in performance.
A substantial deficit. It means they lost basically one extra piece of information out of every 10 just by staying awake for that short period.
And a 10% drop on one test might not sound like a catastrophe, but you scale that across an entire curriculum?
It adds up instantly.
But this is where it gets really stunning, where it validates that shocking premise you mentioned. The researchers followed up 24 hours later.
Yes, after both groups had gone home and had a full night of sleep.
The conventional wisdom would say, oh, they'll catch up overnight.
Right.
Right. If they were just tired, that long, deep sleep should have closed the gap.
That is the logical assumption.
It's wrong.
Completely wrong. The science says absolutely not. The performance losses were not temporary. They were permanent. That 10 percentage point gap was still there, even after a full night of sleep.
Wow.
The conclusion from Spencer's team was just unequivocal. It demands a policy shift. They wrote, performance losses when nap deprived are not recovered during subsequent overnight sleep.
So the nap isn't a luxury. It's a critical, non-negotiable window for memory stabilization for certain kids.
That's it. Once that four-hour window closes and that fragile memory isn't offloaded, the learning is just lost.
So we have to understand why. Why is it irreversible? Why can't the 9 or 10 hours of night sleep, which is so much longer, just pick up the slack?
And this is where we move from just watching behavior to defining the actual neuromechanism. And to explain it, Spencer and her colleague, Tracy Riggins, introduced a fantastic, really accessible metaphor in a 2022 PNAS paper. They call it the hippocampal desk hypothesis.
Okay, so before we get to the desk, let's just clearly define that key term we keep using, the hippocampus.
Good idea.
So if you're listening, picture this structure deep inside your brain's temporal lobe. It's the main receiving center for all your new experiences, facts, spatial information, what scientists call declarative memory.
Think of it like the brain's temporary inbox.
Or, to use the metaphor, the desk where you pile up all your new papers and notes.
Precisely. In an adult brain, that desk is big. It's robust. It can handle a full day of new information and just hold it there, waiting to be filed away during your 8 hours of sleep.
But in kids.
But what Spencer and Riggins found in the developing brain, especially in kids around 4 to 6 years old, is that this desk is dramatically smaller.
So it fills up faster.
Much, much faster.
So if that small desk fills up and you keep the child awake, you keep feeding them new information, new instructions, new sensory details. What happens to those fragile memories from the morning that haven't been filed yet?
They get subjected to what's called interference. They are literally pushed right off the edge of the desk. Permanently.
So new information replaces the old fragile stuff.
Exactly. The child needs frequent offloading through sleep, the brain's version of filing the papers, to clear that desk for the next lesson. If you deny that offloading, you are actively sacrificing the retention of the morning's lessons.
And this isn't just a metaphor. They have actual structural neuroanatomical evidence for this physical difference in the brain, right?
They absolutely do. Using high-resolution magnetic resonance imaging, or MRI scans, they look specifically at the volume of different subfields inside the hippocampus. And they focused on a region called the CA1 hippocampal subfield, which is crucial for forming these declarative memories.
What did they find?
What they found at first was genuinely surprising. The children who were habitual nappers had structurally larger CA1 volumes than the kids who had naturally stopped napping.
Wait, that is counterintuitive. I would think a larger volume would be better, more mature.
You would think so. But it leads to this fascinating neuroanatomical twist that clarifies the whole process of brain maturation. While larger CA1 volumes correlated with the need for napping in the younger kids, they found the exact opposite pattern in older children, from 6 to 8 years old.
Right down there.
In that older group, smaller CA1 volumes actually correlated with better memory performance.
So what does that tell us about how the brain develops?
It suggests the path to cognitive efficiency involves intense synaptic pruning. As the brain matures, it's getting rid of inefficient or redundant connections.
So it's streamlining itself.
Exactly. It leads to a structurally smaller but denser and ultimately more efficient neural network that's highly resistant to that interference we talked about. It's like upgrading from a big, messy physical desk to a sleek, optimized digital storage system.
So the child who naturally stops napping isn't just more compliant. Their brain has physically matured. They have a smaller, more efficient desk that doesn't fill up over a 12-hour day.
Precisely. And the child who still needs that nap has a larger, more plastic, but less efficient desk that simply requires that critical midday clearing.
So for that group, forcing them to skip a nap isn't a behavioral challenge.
No. You are directly disrupting a biologically required neurodevelopmental process. You are disrupting the very thing they need to consolidate the academic content you are trying so hard to teach them.
You're choosing classroom management over permanent learning.
That's the choice, yes.
Okay, so understanding that the nap is essential leads us to the how. What's the actual filing process? What happens in those 70 or 80 minutes of sleep that makes these memories permanent?
To understand the filing system, we have to look at what's called sleep architecture. Sleep isn't just one state. It alternates between two primary phases.
Right. There's non-REM sleep, which is the quieter, deeper phase.
Mm-hmm. And then there's REM sleep, which stands for rapid eye movement sleep. Both are necessary, but they specialize in different types of memory consolidation.
So let's focus on the heavy lifting first. the process that moves facts from that temporary hippocampal desk to long-term storage. That's mainly done during deep sleep, which is formally called slow-wave sleep, or SWS.
Yes, slow-wave sleep, or SWS, is the key ingredient here. On an EEG, you'd see these very large, slow delta waves. But SWS is not a passive resting state.
It's incredibly active.
Incredibly active. It's driving consolidation. During SWS, the hippocampus actively replays recent memories, sometimes at lightning speed, and transmits those patterns over to the neocortex.
And the neocortex is the brain's hard drive. It's the large outer layer responsible for long-term stable storage. So SWS is literally the transfer protocol.
That analogy is perfect. And it really helps explain why young children have such an immense biological need for it. They spend about 25 to 35% of their sleep in SWS.
Which is almost double what adults get.
Almost double. Adults are more like 15 to 20%. This huge amount of SWS in kids points to this critical biological drive to consolidate the vast amounts of new facts and vocabulary they're learning every single day.
And the research has even pinpointed the mechanical signature of this transfer, something called sleep spindles.
They're the crucial coordinating mechanism. Sleep spindles are these brief, fast bursts of neural activity around 11 to 16 hertz that happen mostly during stage 2 non-REM sleep.
And what do they do?
They're believed to be the mechanism that synchronizes the firing between the hippocampus and the neocortex. They're what allows the memory transfer to actually happen.
And Spencer's 2013 PNAS study connected these spindles directly to learning outcomes, right?
The numbers were incredibly compelling. They measured the density of these spindles during the kids' naps and found it significantly correlated with their memory improvement. The correlation coefficient was strong. R equals 0.647.
Okay, let's pause on that statistic. An R value can feel abstract. An R of 0.647 is powerful.
It is.
It means that nearly 42% of the difference in memory improvement between kids could be directly explained by how many sleep spindles they had. It's a direct physical biomarker linking a sleep event to a cognitive outcome.
Exactly. It's not just that they slept, it's how they slept. More spindles meant better consolidation. It confirms that an average 77-minute nap provides ample time for this process.
So SWS and spindles are the filing system for facts. What about the other major component, REM sleep? What's its special role during a nap?
REM sleep, the dreaming state, plays a really specialized role, especially in processing emotional content and language memory. The brain waves during REM look a lot like you're awake, but the body is paralyzed.
And there was a 2018 study in PNAS by Spano that provided direct evidence for its role in language.
Yes. That study found that the percentage of REM sleep a child got during a nap correlated with better retention of object label associations.
So learning new words.
Learning new words and what they mean. It makes perfect sense given the vocabulary explosion happening in the preschool years. The brain prioritizes it.
And they also found evidence of what happens when that REM process is impaired.
They did. They observed that children with conditions like Down syndrome, who typically have less REM sleep, showed memory impairment after their naps, specifically on those language tasks.
So REM isn't just a secondary phase. It's essential, especially for language.
It's an essential, specialized component of the machine. Absolutely critical.
You also mentioned emotional regulation. What about emotionally charged memories or social learning? How does the nap handle that?
Emotional memory is probably the trickiest part. It seems to require both the nap and the subsequent overnight sleep for the full benefit. A 2018 study by Kurdziel found something fascinating.
What was that?
Naps might actually destabilize emotional memories in the short term. It's like the nap breaks down the intense emotional heat of an experience, preparing it for a deeper, more stable integration later on.
So if you're a teacher and you have a lesson with high emotional content, maybe social problem solving or a story about managing frustration, you shouldn't expect immediate mastery right after the nap.
That's the key practical lesson. The full long-term benefit of that emotional learning really emerges the next day after the combined action of the nap and the full night's sleep. If you assess them right after the nap, you might just be seeing that temporary destabilization, not the final consolidated learning.
Which brings us to the most practical part of this for anyone designing a curriculum. We know sleep is required. We know different phases handle different information. So the core question for teaching strategy is this. What should you place on that hippocampal desk right before the filing cabinet turns on? This idea of temporal gating.
You have to prioritize. And that means understanding that not all learning is equally vulnerable to being forgotten. The type of memory dictates the best time to teach it.
Let's start with what gets the biggest, most immediate benefit. That's declarative memory, right? The novel facts, vocabulary, spatial learning.
Correct. Those are the most vulnerable memories because they are so hippocampus dependent. They are the fragile papers on the desk. They need that immediate SWS transfer, which is why they show such robust benefits from the nap.
The nap is their lifeboat.
It is their essential lifeboat against that irreversible forgetting.
Tell us about the Williams and Horst 2014 study on vocabulary. It illustrates this perfectly.
It really does. It involved 3.5-year-olds who were read storybooks with new words. And they found that the children who heard the story shortly before taking a nap performed just as well as children who heard the exact same stories 3 times but stayed awake.
That's incredible. The consolidation power of that one nap was equivalent to 2 extra repetitions.
Exactly. The nap is a massive efficiency multiplier. And the control group, the kids who stayed awake after hearing the story, they never caught up, even when they were tested 7 days later.
Again, reinforcing that principle of irreversible loss.
Absolutely. It highlights the criticality of that post-encoding temporal window.
And what is that window? If the learning happens at 9 a.m., but the nap isn't until 1 p.m., is that too late?
The research suggests a critical window for maximum benefit is about 4 hours. The sequence needs to be tight. Learning a nap within 4 hours consolidation. If you delay the nap much beyond that, the benefit decays rapidly because the information has already been degraded by interference.
You have to front load the novel declarative content right before the rest period.
You absolutely have to.
Let's translate this into meaningful numbers. What is the real world impact on a child's learning over a school year?
We can actually quantify this using meta-analysis. The effect size for napping on declarative memory in preschoolers is really significant. It's measured at Hedges G equal 0.60.
Okay, for our listeners, a Hedges G of 0.60 is considered a large effect in education. It's a massive lever. What does that mean in terms of a percentile shift?
It means that by simply having that strategic nap, a child moves from the 50th percentile on a memory task all the way up to the 73rd percentile.
That's a huge shift.
It's a dramatic shift in retention. You can transform a struggling learner into a high-performing one just by optimizing their sleep schedule.
And if we go back to that 10 percentage point accuracy difference, 75% versus 65 those levers, what does that mean for vocabulary, for example?
It creates this compound advantage over time. If a pre-K curriculum introduces, say, 20 new words a week, that 10% retention difference could translate to 70 to 80 additional stable vocabulary words retained over a school year.
And that's a massive language advantage going into kindergarten, achieved not through more drilling,
but just by optimizing the brain's own maintenance system.
Okay, now for the counterintuitive part of timing, procedural and motor skills. Things like writing, cutting with scissors, learning a finger tapping sequence. Why do teachers need to treat this content differently?
Because of that developmental difference we've been talking about, unlike the immediate boost for facts, preschoolers show no immediate benefit from naps for motor skills. A 2016 study by Disrochers, Kurdziel, and Spencer found no difference in motor skill performance right after the nap versus staying awake.
So the nap didn't hurt, but it didn't give that immediate consolidation boost we saw with words. When did the benefit finally show up?
It was clearly delayed. It only emerged at the 24-hour test after both groups had gotten a full night of overnight sleep. This points to a crucial deferral mechanism in the young brain.
Why the delay? Why does the young brain prioritize facts over skills during that midday SWS?
It comes back to this idea of competition between memory systems. The young child has this huge, biologically mandated need for slow-wave sleep to clear those fragile, hippocampus-dependent memories.
The declarative ones.
The declarative ones. And the hypothesis is that this huge demand for SWS to file facts essentially crowds out the procedural memories for a little while. They get deferred.
Because procedural memories are handled by different brain circuits, right? The striatum, not the hippocampus.
Exactly. So since the child's brain is so invested in clearing that declarative desk, the procedural memories have to wait. They require the combined action of practice during the day, some rest, and then the full nocturnal sleep before the benefit really kicks in. A 2012 review put it perfectly. The children's abundant SWS prevents immediate benefit for procedural memories.
So the practical implication for a teacher's schedule is crystal clear. Motor skill practice, like pencil grip drills or cutting practice,
it belongs in the afternoon block.
But you should delay any assessment of their mastery until the next morning.
You have to. You have to let the nocturnal sleep stabilize the skill first.
Okay, so We've been talking about the child who naps, but by the time kids get to kindergarten, something like 94% of them have naturally stopped napping regularly. So this question of individual variability is incredibly important. Who are we really talking about here?
We're focusing on the critical insight that the need for a nap is a biological reality. It's tied to brain maturation and structure, not just age or habit or a child being stubborn. We have to abandon these blanket age-based policies.
And Spencer's research really clarifies this. It defines two distinct groups of children that can exist in the same classroom.
Exactly. You have the habitual nappers, or HN, who are taking 4, 5 or more naps a week. And then you have the non-habitual nappers, or NN, who take 2 or fewer. They can be the same age, sitting side by side, but they are on fundamentally different biological timetables.
And the test is what happens when you take the nap away from that habitual napper.
When you prevent a habitual napper from napping, they show that catastrophic memory decay. We're talking upwards of a 12 percentage point drop, sometimes reducing their performance to just chance levels on those tasks.
So for them, the nap is essential.
Biologically essential for retention. Meanwhile, the non-habitual nappers, their memory performance stays stable whether they nap or are kept quietly awake.
This means a 4-year-old who still naps is operating with a structurally different brain than a 4-year-old who stopped napping a year ago.
Absolutely. This goes back to the MRI data on the CA1 hippocampal volume. The habitual nappers have those structurally different hippocampi that require that frequent offloading.
So nap cessation isn't a milestone you force.
It is a marker of brain maturation. It tells you that the child's neural networks have matured, the synaptic pruning has done its job, and they are now efficient enough to resist interference across a long day.
So forcing a child whose brain is still wired for that frequent offloading to skip the nap is a huge systemic error. And yet we see it all the time with these age-based nap policies.
It's a profound, critical error. And it's rooted in convenience, not biology. A blanket rule like no naps after age 5 ignores the enormous variation in these biological transition rates. You are actively risking the neurodevelopment of the children who still need it.
Okay, let's make this actionable for the educators and parents listening. What are the clear, specific behavioral signs that a child still needs that midday nap?
Well, the clearest sign is that rapid learning decline we've talked about. But beyond academics, look for clear signs of emotional dysregulation in the late afternoon.
What does that look like?
Increased challenging behaviors, high impulsivity, difficulty managing frustration. It's a signal that the hippocampal desk is overloaded and the brain's regulatory systems are compromised. They just can't stay awake comfortably for 12 plus hours without that crash.
And on the flip side, how do we know a child is biologically ready to transition out of napping?
Their memory performance will stay stable across that long wake interval, and you'll see a reduced sleep drive. They might take 45 minutes or longer to fall asleep at nap time or even bedtime.
Because they just don't have enough sleep pressure built up.
Exactly. And crucially, when they do skip a nap, you'll see their nighttime sleep lengthen, often by an hour or more. That's a sign that their brain is successfully consolidating all its sleep into one single efficient nocturnal bout. It's signaling that the midday break is no longer physiologically necessary.
It's so easy to get caught up in the drama of the nap, but we have to anchor this all back to the absolute foundation. Nighttime sleep. That's still the primary stabilizer for everything, right?
Absolutely. The benchmark for preschoolers ages 3 to 5 is extensive. They need 10 to 13 hours of sleep in a 24-hour period. And when that benchmark is consistently missed, even by a little bit, the effects are insidious.
The prefrontal cortex, the CEO of the brain, is the first thing to go offline.
Precisely. Chronic sleep restriction, and we're talking even small amounts, like 5 nights of just a 1.4-hour reduction, that selectively impairs hippocampal-dependent memory encoding. We saw this in studies on a specific skill called pattern separation.
Okay, let's elaborate on pattern separation. Because for anyone preparing a child for kindergarten, that is a critical foundational skill.
It is. Pattern separation is the ability to tell the difference between similar but distinct things. So in a classroom, that's distinguishing between the letter B and the letter D.
Or similar sounding words like cat and cap.
Exactly. Or even separating the memory of going to the park from the memory of going to the grocery store. When a child is sleep restricted, their ability to do this is selectively reduced. Their brain starts lumping similar things together.
And you can't learn to read or do math if you can't tell 6 from 9 or was from saw.
The very foundation of literacy and numeracy just crumbles under a chronic sleep deficit.
And the really insidious part is that this cognitive damage is often invisible, because the behavioral symptoms don't look like a tired, yawning adult.
That's the greatest danger, yeah. And the highest risk for misdiagnosis. Sleep deprivation in young children does not manifest as visible fatigue. Instead, it destabilizes the brain's regulatory centers. So the symptoms look like classic behavioral challenges.
Hyperactivity, impulsiveness, aggression.
Poor mood regulation, decreased attention span, high defiance. All the behaviors that disrupt a classroom.
And if an educator or a clinician sees that list of symptoms, they immediately risk falling into the misdiagnosis trap.
The risk is huge. These symptoms closely mimic the diagnostic criteria for ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And this can lead to all sorts of unnecessary interventions when the root cause is physiological. Not enough sleep.
So the standard protocol should change.
It has to. Addressing chronic insufficient sleep must be the first upstream intervention before you consider any other diagnosis. If the child is sleep deprived, their prefrontal cortex is offline. The impulsive limbic system is in charge. Of course, they're hyperactive.
You mentioned emotional volatility earlier, too. How does that play in?
The research is so clear here. Sleep is essential for emotional processing. We saw that nap-deprived preschoolers respond 22 milliseconds faster to emotional faces.
Which sounds good, but it's not.
It's not. It's a neurological sign of heightened emotional sensitivity. They're processing things faster, which leads to overreaction because the emotional charge from yesterday hasn't been properly filed away. They're bringing old emotional baggage into today's learning.
So let's talk practical interventions. What are the high-impact things parents and educators can do to support that foundational nighttime sleep?
Consistency. It's the single most powerful tool you have. Consistent bedtimes and wake times regulate the child's internal body clock, their circadian rhythm, and that alignment directly increases the amount of restorative slow-wave sleep. The brain thrives on predictability.
And the research points to a small but high-yield intervention involving language right before bed.
Yes. Implementing a language-based bedtime routine, specifically reading or storytelling, serves a powerful dual function. First, you get that critical language exposure right before the longest consolidation period.
And second?
Mechanically, this simple routine improves total sleep duration by about 0.2 hours per night.
12 minutes. It doesn't sound like a game changer.
But it accumulates. That seemingly small gain translates to roughly 73 additional hours of sleep per year. That's nearly 3 full days of extra rest and consolidation time, achieved just through a consistent, language-rich routine.
Which is why schools have to see communicating about sleep health not as external advice.
But as a foundational instructional resource, it is part of the curriculum for cognitive success.
Okay, so we've established the mechanisms, the vulnerable hippocampal desk, SWS and REM, facts versus skills, the role of nighttime sleep. Now we can put it all together.
Now we can synthesize this into an actionable schedule template, a blueprint. The goal is that temporal gating structuring the day to stabilize memories during that critical window.
This is a radical shift. Mm-hmm. It's moving beyond just grouping subjects and into optimizing instruction based on how the brain is actually working. So let's start with the morning.
The morning block is for maximum effort. Block one. Morning block 8:00–11:30 a.m. should be dedicated to peak cognitive demand. This is where you do your core academic instruction.
So complex math, science concepts, problem solving, introducing difficult new facts.
Exactly. The rationale is twofold. First, it aligns with peak alertness for most young kids. Studies show 58.4% of 2- to 4-year-olds are morning types. This ensures their executive function, capacity, attention, working memory is at its highest.
And second.
And critically for the nappers, it places the learning well within that 4-hour window before their midday rest.
Which leads us to the most powerful instructional time of the entire day, the hour right before that rest.
Yes. Block two, pre-nap learning block, 11:30 a.m., 12:30 p.m. This is for declarative content front loading. This time must be strategically used for the novel declarative content that needs immediate stabilization.
The vocabulary, tricky letter sound mappings, spatial concepts like map reading.
That's it. This is the moment to load up that hippocampal desk right before the filing system turns on. The learning has to happen immediately before the SWS window to prevent that irreversible forgetting.
So teaching complex math at 8 a.m. is a risk if the nap isn't until 1 p.m.
You're risking 4 hours of interference. If you teach it at 12 p.m., you are maximizing the transfer.
Which brings us to the implementation challenge.
Yeah.
The rest period itself.
Block three, nap quiet rest period. 12:30 2.00 p.m. This has to be a protected 90-minute mandatory period of low stimulation and sleep opportunity. It is not optional. It is physiologically mandated for the habitual nappers.
But this is where it gets tough. How do you manage that in a classroom with a mix of habitual and non-habitual nappers? You can't force every child to sleep.
It requires differentiated instruction during the rest period itself. For the habitual nappers, you actively promote sleep. Dark, quiet, consistent routine. For the non-habitual nappers, you provide a quiet alternative activity, looking at books, quiet puzzles.
But the key is consistency.
The start time has to be consistent for everyone. Mm. That SWS happens maximally early in the nap, so timing is absolutely critical for the nappers.
Okay, so they wake up, the brain has been cleared, stabilized, the desk is empty. What happens in the afternoon?
Block four, post-nap block, 2.30430 p.m. is for application, rehearsal, and procedural skills. This is the time for review, creative play, physical activity, and critically, all of your motor skill practice.
Handwriting drills, fine motor tasks, anything that relies on muscle memory.
Correct. We practice those skills in the afternoon because we know the procedural benefits are delayed. They only emerge after the full 24-hour cycle, after that overnight sleep.
So you don't assess their writing today. You let their brain wire it up overnight.
Exactly. And this afternoon block also accommodates the roughly 32% of kids who are evening or intermediate chronotypes and perform better later in the day. It provides a secondary peak performance window.
So the blueprint creates this deliberate rhythm. High effort encoding in the morning, immediate stabilization of facts at midday, skill practice in the afternoon, and then long-term integration overnight.
It perfectly illustrates the principle of distributed sleep. Understanding that the total 24-hour sleep duration is necessary, but it's not sufficient. Both bouts, the nap and the night, serve complementary specialized functions.
Naps for immediate stabilization.
And overnight sleep for long-term integration and deep emotional processing. Both are physiological requirements for optimal early learning.
So, to synthesize this entire deep dive, what are the key takeaways that should fundamentally change how we approach these schedules?
I think it boils down to three. First, key takeaway one is the urgency and irreversibility. For those kids in your care who still habitually nap, missing that nap causes irreversible memory loss for complex morning learning. Overnight sleep cannot fix it.
So the nap period is instructional infrastructure. It's not free time.
It must be protected. Second, key takeaway two is the optimized blueprint. Use temporal gating. Place your novel declarative learning immediately before the nap. Schedule procedural skills for the afternoon and delay assessing them until the next morning.
And the third.
Key takeaway three is individualized policy. Nap policies have to be individualized based on observable biological need, not standardized by age, and hyperactivity, impulsivity, attention issues. They should always be viewed first as potential signs of chronic sleep deficit.
We have to treat sleep deficiency as a primary threat to executive function.
Absolutely.
And here's where we can challenge the status quo. We have this specific replicable neuroscience showing the need for a 70 to 90 minute SWS-rich protected sleep window for these kids. Yet current policy in many places like the mandate in Massachusetts only requires a 45-minute rest period.
A policy which, as Rebecca Spencer herself notes, is based on nothing in particular.
It's based on nothing. The political and logistical difficulty of doing this right is immense, but the trade-off is so clear. Permanent memory loss versus effective learning.
That's the choice.
We now have the neuroscience. We have the effect sizes, the timing windows. We know the hippocampal desk is real, and for many young learners, it fills up fast. The choice is between designing schedules based on assumption or implementing evidence-based blueprints that treat sleep as the necessary non-negotiable infrastructure for making learning permanent.
This is a fight for retention, not just for rest.
We owe it to the next generation of learners to protect the time it takes to file those memories away. Find full research and sources at research.yuda.me, that's yuda.me,